I am joined here by Sarah. Sarah, would you like to just introduce yourself and what you do?
Thank you very much for having me. My name's Sarah Mbagobunu. I'm the Regional Director for IFAD, the International Fund for Agricultural Development, for Eastern Southern Africa, based out of Nairobi, Kenya. In fact, as Regional Director, I oversee a portfolio of about $7 billion, US dollars, 50 ongoing programs and projects, co-financed with other international financial institutions, multilateral development banks, but also the Green Climate Fund, Adaptation Fund, and others. And so we're providing oversight through this. We have a whole pocket of sovereign operations where we provide sovereign loans to governments under the umbrella of sustainable development finance. And we have about three or four thematic areas where we are strongly trying to reach smallholder farmers and in trying to promote rural transformation and transformations of food systems globally, both for the planet, but also for human nutritional gain. And so we have a portfolio working with rural inclusive finance, trying to get finance and financial services into the hands of smallholder farmers. It's one set. We also have a blue portfolio where we're working with aquaculture and fisheries. Again, have returns on nutrition, but also to create jobs. And we also have a wide sort of livestock dairy portfolio. We have a rural youth entrepreneurship portfolio, really focusing on rural jobs and skilling, equipping young people to either start enterprises or to be competitive in the labor market. And finally, our other portfolio really looks at biodiversity and nature positive solutions, rehabilitation, restoring landscapes, restoring water catchment areas, rangeland pasture, and trying to monetize returns to nature. So that's what we're doing. And all of this, of course, we have small scale farmers who are very important in terms of our ecosystem and, of course, also our food systems at the center of all that we do as at IFAD.
Okay, got it. And could you speak on why it's important to be investing in these small-scale farmers and why it's a priority for our world today?
The very first thing is that smallholder farmers are really at the front line of climate change. We know that. They inhabit some of the most vulnerable landscapes, such as hillsides, rangelands, semi-arid and arid lands, deltas and floodplains, and rely on climate-sensitive natural resources to make a living. Globally, there's about 500 million of them, and they are the major producers of our food. So if we do not support them in being able to manage these natural assets, then this twofold impact: increase in hunger that we have seen, a doubling of since 2020, and of course, decline in our ability to feed ourselves going forward, and that doesn't help. More importantly, in the context of Africa, particularly Eastern Southern Africa, which only contributes about 4% of greenhouse gas emissions, but is bearing the brunt of climate change. I don't know if you were aware when you saw the drought in the Horn of Africa and all those cattle dying, but also the cyclone in current cyclones, Mozambique, Malawi, Madagascar. That just shows how vulnerable the region is and how vulnerable and how exposed basically the smallholder farmers are. The third reason, of course, is that agriculture serves as the backbone of livelihoods and national economies here in Eastern Southern Africa, and also supports a substantial portion of the labor force, of which 62% are employed in the food sector. So if this food sector declines in productivity, then we can actually see 34% decrease in agricultural productivity growth. That's one, but also a devastation of culture heritage and of livelihoods.
So, what would you say are some main ways that smallholder farms have been able to benefit from IFAD and from loans from the international community?
Well, I think firstly, we know that there is impact when you invest in them. But just to say that even though we are all looking at climate adaptation as a key piece of the solution against climate change, smallholder farmers in Eastern Southern Africa only getting 1.5% of that resource. So having said that, we as an assembler of development finance, we're trying to crowd in as much finance as possible. Our business model looks at crowding domestic finance, international co-financing, and talked about the climate finance. It's still just 1.5%. So that's clearly not enough. But where we have been able to reach small scale farmers, and that's your question, we have seen tremendous returns. So maybe just as an example, I would like to talk a little bit about the wool and mohair project in Lesotho, for instance, which is looking at supporting those smallholder farmers in entering the sustainable fiber market. And we're working with the big players in the industry to introduce traceability systems. And we understand that with the introduction of traceability systems, you can actually see the small wool mohair growers changing their rangeland management practices. So they're taking better care of their rangeland, they're intensifying their production, and then they're changing the and using renewable energy for their shearing sheds. And all of these collectively will enable them to get a triple income as they enter the sustainable fiber market, as opposed to the normal fiber market, which isn't sustainable in terms of textiles. So we're recrafting and rebuilding those systems in order to enable them benefit twofold, whilst we also get a return on nature. That's one of the things that we have seen. In the Kenya context, we have introduced a digital voucher so that small-scale farmers that we are reaching are able to access agricultural inputs through agro dealers. And this digital voucher enables the government of the Republic of Kenya to reduce on a reducing subsidy, the supporting the farmers to access agricultural inputs. But the menu of in on that voucher also includes climate insurance, so they can get covered for whether it's drought or floods. It also includes bio fertilizers. It also includes technologies which have been adapted to soil, and it also includes a component of technical assistance ag extension. So this is exciting because then it really enables smallholder farmers to get the menu of integrated package of services that they need from the agro dealer nearest to them, and the voucher is redeemed through the banking system. So that's working pretty well, and we want to really scale that up and introduce more regenerative agricultural practices as we scale it up to other counties in the country.
Wow, that's so interesting. Those are all really cool initiatives. Thank you so much for sharing them. I know that you're based in Nairobi and that you work specifically with East and Southern Africa with INIFAD. So I was wondering if you can speak a bit about the regional context and how things might differ for the smallholder farms within Eastern and Southern Africa compared to other parts of the world and the different priorities that might exist.
Well, no, I think that there's really a lot of potential in East and Southern Africa. I think that's what maybe, which, if tapped, would be able to unlock so much more in terms of domestic jobs. At the moment, there's quite a lot of food that's imported, like cooking oil, into the region, which doesn't necessarily have to be. I think we are a net producer of dairy in this region. I think we're the global producers of beans and pulses, which also have really great returns for the soil. We have opportunity to invest in these sectors, really bringing about opportunities to reduce methane, and potentially also introducing new types of enterprises like fodder, using manure in different ways to create greener jobs in some of these sectors. I think there's a whole lot that has still to be done around markets, because infrastructure is still relatively low. But where there is infrastructure, we do see, the fragmented markets building in. And of course, I don't know whether you've had the opportunity to come to East Africa, but we are known in Africa for big open markets, but there's opportunities for local authorities to really upgrade these markets and introduce more modern food distribution systems, like you'd have auction houses that you'd see in Japan and so on. We only have two auctions in East and Southern Africa, one in Zimbabwe for I think it's for tobacco, and in South Africa. So changing those distribution mechanisms in urban settings, which are growing really rapidly, would actually reduce the cost of food. and the cost of transport of that food and empower smallholder farmers to actually bring their produce into town every morning and get it auctioned off. Right now, they are going into large open air markets, which are not necessarily the standards. There's lots of food waste and loss because of those systems, and there's inadequate storage, inadequate refrigeration. So there's all of these opportunities are still open to actually invest in from the private sector and actually close those gaps. And I shouldn't, I should end it with saying that COVID taught us a lesson in these urban areas. A lot went digital in terms of trying to order food and using motorbikes to deliver most of that. So that experience has come in. And the digital, I mean, economy now, I understand, is in, approximately 11 trillion worldwide. And so if we build on that, that digital using also mobile money to transact, we can actually get small scale farmers reaching retail urban markets much, much easier. And having traders being able to go and collect the produce much easier as well. So all of these are really opportunities and low-hanging fruit that we can build in on Eastern Southern Africa. The population is relatively young, so there's quite a lot there already. And probably, introducing renewable energies that could actually unlock electricity and energy would do go a long way in terms of tapping into opportunities.
I think what I'm definitely learning from our conversation is that investing in and empowering the rural sector is so multifaceted. You've mentioned so many interesting projects, like you mentioned earlier, bolstering auction houses as well as distribution methods. I think these are things that I never would have even thought of when it comes to kind of solutions or projects for empowering smallholder farms and farmers. So I was wondering maybe if you have other examples of interesting or unexpected projects that one might not think of immediately, but are interesting projects that you have IFAD has been embarking on to really invest in the sector.
I know, I mean, I think, we were all challenged to see how, how we can crowd in more resources at each and every level because the demand is and the expectations are huge. And the impact of climate change is enormous. So we have been partnering, for instance, with the Green Climate Fund's private sector window to work with Equity Bank, which is a private financial institution here. And they've actually borrowed from the Green Climate Fund. And together with ourselves, we're trying to work with Equity Bank to develop a taxonomy of green enterprises and what that would look like, and trying to get and incentivize them to also lend to smallholder farmers. So this is a way of trying to crowd in the private sector through facilities like this to leverage more in terms of resource. We have now a growing non-sovereign, what we're calling non-sovereign operation, where we're working directly with the private sector, and they can take senior junior loans up to, between 3.5, 5 million, and then they are actually using those funds to prepare as a market and offtake from smallholder farmers, building the logistical chains that don't exist. And like in Madagascar, we've been working very closely on that. And that's been very interesting because definitely in that case, the government isn't borrowing. There's no risk of, indebtedness. And it's the private company that's borrowing at a very reasonable rate, but they're really working with our targeted groups and working with smallholder farmers in a fair way, at the same time introducing regenerative agricultural practices. So you still have that return, triple type of return. In other instances, we've been working mainly, as I mentioned, with youth, and the youth space is really, really interesting. In trying to work through challenge funds to enable them either to have startups that would work for them, and this is agri off-farm services, so they can provide different types of this transport services. For the agricultural sector, whether it is weeding services, whether it is harvesting services, and having all those much needed services in small towns that actually provide them with a livelihood, and we also facilitate internships so they can actually learn. I remember going to Rwanda and seeing this enterprise, which is a dairy enterprise, and they opted to only hire and provide an internship for young people who have a hearing, physically challenged by hearing. And so everybody in that particular processing plant spoke in sign language. They got skills on how to receive milk, pasteurize milk, make yogurt, make cheese, make. And then the ideas would stay there for about 8 months and then come into work every day, really learn the trade and the craft. And then they can go back and start their own milk enterprises. So that was a very powerful way of using people and community to do it. So there's all these ways that you can really craft programs that are, that work with community and through community. And I talked about this rural entrepreneurship program. They actually identify a series of rural entrepreneurs, whether they're in piggery, chicken poultry, and so on, and they were basically facilitating, after a standard 3 months, 4 months vocational skills program, young people would have internships with them and have them as their mentors for another year, where they would actually learn practical experiences of how to establish these types of enterprises, and have mentoring, access to coaching, and a small grant. And going back to see the ones who are successful, it's really a very powerful story when you see that they have been able to settle down, they have decided to start their own families, they have, graduated into something, some of them have built homes for themselves. It's very powerful to see the different configurations of very nice programs.
That's awesome. That must be very rewarding to see all the work that's been done and how these youth have benefited from the programs. I'm also wondering, across all the projects that you work on, what are some of the main challenges or obstacles you would say that still remain to be overcome in order to achieve the goals that you set out to do?
Across East and Southern Africa, we still have the, small and medium enterprises that are underrepresented. And that's why we don't add as much value and can't create as much, as many jobs in the context. And I think part of that is the challenges of infrastructure, but also limited access to electrification and energy services as a whole. So when there's a challenge like that, there's also an opportunity. So there's an opportunity to start off right with green energy, as opposed to continuing with unclean energy. So I think that's the challenge that Eastern Southern Africa has. So if we can come in with other actors who are actually looking at the energy piece, so we do invest, for instance, in irrigation schemes. And in irrigation schemes, you could, add to that mini high, hybrid renewable energy plants that could then support the irrigation on the one side of it, and then you can harvest 3 times a year, so you can double or triple your income. But you can at the same time access electricity that really is transformative at household level. You have refrigeration, you can read in the evenings, you can do so many other things, and actually process food for storage and so on, extend shelf life. In terms of how we work quite a lot with, directly with government through project management units. There's a lot there that we can also do to improve capacities, improve efficiency in working with those structures, where we work with the private sector is really direct. So, those projects are as strong as a private sector actor is. And combining those loans with technical assistance really helps, because then you can really combine the skill sets that's needed to reach more farmers. So I think that's key. And then, of course, some of the contexts we work with in South Sudan, for instance, a very young country, 12 years old, all the policies are not in place. There's some parts of the country where you don't have government representation or public services or even access to adequate public services. So where you have contexts like that, where there's real gaps, And when we work really in the last mile. So we'd go to a country and then not remain in the capital and go to the borders of that country. The further away you get from the center, the lower the services, the lower the quality of the service, and more expensive to get there. That's why people want to move to urban areas. But I think with what is happening, particularly in terms of climate change, those areas that have diverse biodiversity that could actually be the bastion of turning around some of what we're seeing, become more important. And getting governments to think in investing in those areas in a slightly different way from the way that they used to. I mean, I think that's where the challenge really lies. And there's a few people who are working in the policy space, but really driving through those right policies, really accounting for nature and looking to say, what do we invest now and what do we get 10 years, 15 years down the road, is going to be a very important element for policymakers to make and make sure that they are looking at their plans and investing in the right way.
Yeah, for sure. I do have one last question for you. I'm wondering, for our audience of McGill students and young people who are passionate about sustainability and climate change adaptation and want to help and contribute with, the goals of empowering the rural sector and smallholder farms, I think if you have any advice for students like us.
Well, I mean, I was really interested and excited. We also work with grants and we also have other instruments. So I had the opportunity to visit a youth group who were actually using a crowd-funded platform to present, this was in Kenya, their business plans. And then other youth were actually contributing to fund that enterprise. And they did different things. They had milk kiosks, they were selling milk. Some of them were processing maize into flour. Some of them were in chicken feed. So it was really, they just talked about their journey, about how they managed to develop their business plan, did a bit of marketing, and then plugged it on. And this crowdsourcing platform was actually all young people. So they literally financed themselves. So that's a great way. I mean, I think all of you are in GoFundMe campaigns or and I don't know how to make those more structural. That's one way of doing it. We're also having a program looking at remittances, for instance. So the diaspora that's out there seeing an interesting investment opportunity in a rural area and then deciding to invest in that and sending remittances back. The other one is just sharing your experience, your expertise, your skill sets with your rural counterparts who might not necessarily have access to all the knowledge, technologies that you have. It could be also another way of doing it. I think there's a lot that you can do in especially because now they also use all these other media, social media platforms that you can share your ideas, whether it is through TikTok or others, that could also help in bridging this. I think the essence is that farming doesn't necessarily have to be in the traditional ways in which previous generations farmed. Another young entrepreneur was growing all the vegetables and potato stacks, very sustainable way, in a very small space, but it was vertical farming, hardly using any space at all, and using that, and he was able to make a very good living from that without necessarily having lots of land, just soil in potatoes, and was able to harvest. So I think just sharing those ideas, many, many people here in Eastern Southern Africa go to YouTube to learn things, how to do things like that. If they want to get a new skill, and then they go onto YouTube and they learn through that. So there's some other ways in which you can share your knowledge and skills, but definitely insisting on more responsible and sustainable consumption is very key. And I think one of the ways that could be really transformative is if we go down, reduce the imports and source locally, Shorten supply chains and really start buying all the fresh produce that you can locally instead of importing. This stuff would be very, very helpful, and your advocacy would definitely be, adding your voices to that push would be very helpful.
All right, for sure, and that's very valuable. And with that, we'll bring our conversation to a close. Thank you so much, Sarah, for joining us and sharing about what Yvette's been working on and all these interesting projects that you've been embarking on and also the challenges that you're working to overcome. I really appreciate you taking the time to come and chat with us.
Thank you.